The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the December 27th, 2013 edition of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. The gun debate 1 year after Newtown. What happened? The first anniversary of the school shootings in Newtown, Connecticut, reignited the debate over gun control this week, as another school shooting in Colorado ended with one student severely injured and only the gunman killed. The small Connecticut town where Adam Lanza gunned down 20 first graders and six adults in Sandy Hook Elementary School observed the anniversary largely in private after town leaders asked the media to stay away. President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama lit candles in the White House and honored the dead with a moment of silence. The president addressed gun safety in his weekly address to the nation, saying Congress had failed to legislate a solution. "We haven't yet done enough to make our communities and our country safer," he said. "We have to do more to keep dangerous people from getting their hands on a gun so easily." On the eve of the Newtown anniversary, a student opened fire in a high school in Centennial, Colorado, shooting and injuring one student before killing himself. Carl Halverson Pearson, 18, entered the school with a shotgun and two Molotov cocktails, intending to kill a debate coach who had disciplined him and possibly to kill others. Authorities acted quickly to evacuate the school and corner the shooter. It was the 28th school shooting in the year since the Newtown massacre. A new Associated Press poll found that 52% of Americans supported stronger gun control legislation, down from 61% in the immediate aftermath of Newtown. What the editorial said. "We have failed," said the Chicago Sun-Times. "We thought the appalling sight of classrooms full of dead kids might finally push our lawmakers to address the specter of gun violence in America." Yeah, well, so much for that. Since Newtown, Congress has done precisely nothing on gun control, ignoring President Obama's call for stronger background checks and a ban on the sale of military-style weapons and high-capacity magazines. "There are glimmers of good news coming out of the states," said the Washington Post. Eight states, including California, Connecticut, and Maryland, passed bills since Newtown strengthening gun control, denting the image of invincibility enjoyed by the National Rifle Association. But about two-thirds of all gun laws passed since then actually weakened controls, said the San Jose Mercury News. Given the powerful hold of fear and loyalty that the gun lobby exerts over conservative lawmakers, this will be a long fight. What the columnist said. "Why are we still debating gun control?" said Charles C.W. Cook in NationalReview.com. "The measures proposed by congressional Democrats would do nothing to stop future massacres. Adam Lanza's rampage with guns legally purchased by his mother would not have been prevented by stronger background checks or more restrictions on gun sellers. Liberals' obsessive focus on gun control has actually made us less safe," said Jeb Babin in Spectator.org. "Congress and state lawmakers have ignored the only measure that might avert more atrocities, getting the dangerous mentally ill off the streets." Gun control advocates should accept that their tactics haven't worked, said Jeffrey Goldberg in Bloomberg.com. The NRA has better funding, more dedicated and passionate followers, and the emotion-driven cause of preserving constitutional freedom. What's more, most Americans realize that the piecemeal fixes proposed by gun reformers are mainly symbolic. A more useful debate would be about the relevance of Second Amendment protections in a country where crime is falling and few people hunt anymore. Not that this is going to happen anytime soon. Don't bet against it, said Adam Winkler in NewRepublic.com. Newtown reinvigorated the gun control movement after 2 decades of inaction. Gun control advocacy groups now have money, too, thanks to benefactors like outgoing New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. California and Massachusetts felt empowered to pass gun control legislation they might otherwise have treated as a hot potato. Of course, the gun lobby has fought back mightily, loosening gun restrictions in 9 states and recalling pro-gun control lawmakers in Colorado. But now, both sides are politically powerful and making their voices heard. With a genuine debate underway, sanity may yet prevail. NSA surveillance ruled unconstitutional. What happened? The National Security Agency suffered a major blow this week after a federal judge ruled that its mass collection of domestic phone data almost certainly violates the Constitution, setting up an eventual review of the controversial program by the Supreme Court. U.S. District Judge Richard Leon, who was appointed by President George W. Bush, slammed the NSA's program as almost Orwellian and declared its record-keeping on virtually every phone call made in the U.S. a violation of the Fourth Amendment's prohibition on unreasonable searches. Leon also said the government had no evidence that metadata collection actually stopped an imminent attack. The NSA's program will continue, however, until an expected government appeal is heard. But in response to the ruling, the White House rushed the release of a report by an independent task force charged with assessing and reforming the NSA's surveillance activities. Those activities have faced fierce criticism in the U.S. and abroad, following a series of revelations by former agency contractor Edward Snowden about their vast scope. In its report, the task force recommended reining in the surveillance in several ways, including curbing wiretaps on foreign leaders and requiring the telecom companies, not the NSA, to hold on to metadata such as logs of phone calls. The agency would then request specific records on a case-by-case basis. Obama will review the report and is expected to announce an overhaul of the agency in January. What the editorial said. Leon has overstepped his authority, said the Wall Street Journal. He should have abided by a 1979 Supreme Court decision, which declared that individuals have no reasonable expectation of privacy over information they hand to telephone companies. The same should hold true for anyone who uses the Internet or otherwise benefits from modern technology. Besides, the NSA's data collection is hardly intrusive, since its database of phone calls does not include callers' names or addresses. But as Leon rightly pointed out, the surveillance that led to the 1979 decision in no way resembles the NSA's all-encompassing spying on every American, said the Los Angeles Times. In that previous case, data collection was tightly targeted at specific criminal suspects, while the NSA now indiscriminately makes records of millions of calls every day. As Leon also pointed out, today's cell phones even generate records of their users' exact location throughout the day. What the columnist said. This ruling should be a wake-up call to America, said Jay Bookman in AJC.com. The NSA has become drunk on the power of modern technology and is intent on knowing all and storing all and seeing all. We now have two options. Either put strict restrictions on the NSA's surveillance of citizens or write off the Fourth Amendment as technologically obsolete. You're being hysterical, said Robert Turner in the Wall Street Journal. There is a tremendous difference between collecting metadata and actually searching it. During the whole of 2012, the NSA searched just 300 telephone numbers in its database. Only people who were suspected of communicating with foreign terrorists were targeted. The capability to track such contacts is a key weapon in the fight against Al-Qaeda, said former Secretary of Homeland Security Michael Chertoff in USA Today. In leading up to 9/11, investigators lost track of one hijacker because they couldn't follow the phone trail between a safe house in Yemen and the U.S., a link the NSA would be able to make today. The U.S. must not revive the pre-9/11 hamstrings that proved so costly over a decade ago. Thanks to Snowden, America is now having a critically important debate, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg.com. Until his leaks, the government shrouded its mass surveillance program in secrecy, not primarily to fool terrorists, who certainly know that we're listening, but to protect itself from us and the outrage we're now seeing. American citizens, not faceless spies and bureaucrats at the NSA, should determine the proper balance between privacy and security. That, in the end, is what makes us a democracy. The controversy of the week. The GOP. Are party leaders divorcing the Tea Party? Can this marriage be saved? Said Donna Cassata in the Associated Press. It was only a few years ago that the Tea Party movement, along with well-funded activist groups such as Heritage Action and the Club for Growth, helped the Republican Party seize control of the House in the 2010 midterms. Now, however, that relationship may be headed for a classic political divorce. After the House approved a bipartisan budget deal last week, Speaker John Boehner lashed out in anger when he was asked why hardcore conservative groups were denouncing the agreement as a sellout. His eyes blazing, Boehner said the groups were attacking a budget they hadn't even read yet and accused them of pressuring Republicans into unpopular stances. They pushed us into this fight to defund Obamacare and to shut down the government, he said. Frankly, I just think they've lost all credibility. Even conservative darling Representative Paul Ryan sided with Boehner, said Dana Milbank in WashingtonPost.com. You don't get everything you want in divided government, Ryan said, adding that he's frustrated with demands for purity on deficits and every issue. Looks like the Tea Party reign of terror is over. That would be a good thing for both the country and the Republican Party, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Polls show that the American people, including most Republicans, have had enough of the shutdown mentality, espoused by the hardline groups. As Republicans head into an election year with a decent shot of taking back the Senate, letting the Tea Partiers keep calling the shots would be a critical mistake. These activist groups don't even care about winning elections, said Linda Chavez in the New York Post. Their primary goal is fundraising. And to stoke up the base, their tone is consistently hysterical. That's why they portray even loyal Republicans as traitors. Boehner had no choice but to push back. By passing the best budget deal they could forge with Democrats, he and other Republican leaders look like grown-ups capable of governing. Pay no attention to this little spat, said Brian Butler in Salon.com. The GOP's leadership has to make a show of independence from the Tea Party, so as not to scare off moderate voters in the midterms. But it remains true that the biggest differences on the right are strategic, not substantive. Boehner, Ryan, and the rest remain committed to blocking Obama at every turn and to pursuing a far-right agenda on taxes, spending, and immigration. Boehner might be a pragmatist, but he isn't a moderate, said Jamel Bowie in the DailyBeast.com. Immediately after whining about conservative wing nuts, Boehner blocked a vote on extending unemployment benefits. Don't hold your breath for bipartisanship to break out in Washington. Don't be so sure of that, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Republican leaders seem to have finally figured out that they're not going to take back the Senate or the White House in 2016 by campaigning as the party of no. They need to work alongside Democrats at the task of governance and offer their own constructive solutions to the country's problems. It wouldn't take much for the GOP to rebuild its image, say by resuscitating the bill on comprehensive immigration reform that the Tea Party hated. Then voters could find themselves once again presented with two competing visions of how to move the nation forward, instead of one vision and one cartoon. On the briefing page, the Christmas truce. On December 25th, 1914, the guns of British and German troops fell silent, and soldiers sang carols in no man's land. Why is this truce still remembered? In a horrific war that claimed the lives of 10 million soldiers, the Christmas truce represents an extraordinary moment of human kinship. When the First World War broke out in the summer of 1914, most soldiers assumed they'd be home by Christmas. 4 months later, almost a million men already died, with no end in sight. Amid that carnage came the truce. Starting with a handful of sporadic ceasefires between exhausted British and German soldiers in the trenches of Western Europe, the unauthorized truce spread along the 500-mile Western Front, encompassing more than 100,000 men. Sworn enemies crept out into no man's land to exchange food, sing carols, tell jokes, and even play soccer. A day later, savage warfare recommenced. But the impromptu display of humanity has endured as one of the most bittersweet episodes of World War I. It was a day of peace in war, wrote one German soldier. It is only a pity that it was not decisive peace. When did the ceasefires begin? On Christmas Eve, when British soldiers recovering the bodies of their dead comrades near Ypres, Belgium, noticed the Germans decorating their trenches and singing the Christmas carol Stille Nacht, or Silent Night, the Brits sang, O Come All Ye Faithful, in response. And then one of the Germans challenged any one of us to go across for a bottle of wine, wrote a soldier. One of our fellows accepted the challenge and took a big cake to exchange. Soldiers who hours earlier were trying to kill each other shook hands, wished each other a Merry Christmas, and were soon conversing as if we had known each other for years, wrote Corporal John Ferguson. The festivities spread across the front line and continued into Christmas Day, with soldiers swapping stories and exchanging cigarettes. Did they really play soccer? Several impromptu games broke out all across no man's land, with soldiers kicking either an actual ball or empty corned beef cans, with their steel helmets acting as goalposts. But there was one particular match between the Germans and Brits that has become legendary. That between the 133rd Royal Saxon Regiment and some Scottish troops playing in tartan kilts. Lieutenant Johann Niemann of the 133rd said that a Scottish soldier appeared with a football which seemed to come from nowhere, and a few minutes later, a real football match got underway. Spirits were high, and us Germans really roared when a gust of wind revealed that the Scots wore no drawers under their kilts. The final score? Germany 3, Britain 2. Was the truce universal? No, and some of the combatants actively disapproved. Major John Hawksley said that the Seaforths, a Scottish regiment, would have none of it, and when the Germans in front of them tried to fraternize and leave their trenches, the Seaforths warned them that they would shoot. Meanwhile, the Russians, who still adhered to the Julian calendar and wouldn't celebrate Christmas until January 7th, carried on fighting on the Eastern Front. While French soldiers were understandably opposed to laying down arms, given that a third of their country was under German occupation. One Austrian-born soldier, meanwhile, thought that the fraternization with the enemy was disgraceful. "Such things should not happen in wartime," said Corporal Adolf Hitler, according to one of his comrades in the 16th Bavarians. "Have you Germans no sense of honor left at all?" How did the truce end? As civilly as it had begun, Major Hawksley, who was killed by a sniper in France in 1916, said that German troops took the trouble to send notes to their British counterparts warning that hostilities were about to resume. "Gentlemen, our automatic pistol has been ordered from the colonel to begin to fire again at midnight. We take it an honor to award you of this fact," wrote one. "Funny, isn't it?" noted Hawksley. British and German soldiers along the front line solemnly said farewell to their new friends. "With that we parted," wrote one, "and in all probability in the course of a day or so, we shall be doing our utmost to kill each other." Were there other truces? No. Military leaders on both sides opposed fraternization and ordered heavy artillery, machine guns, and sniper fire on December 25th to discourage festive meetings. As the war and the carnage dragged on, both sides became too embittered to complete ceasefires. Even those taking part in the 1914 truce recognized the occasion as a fleeting moment of kinship, unlikely to be experienced again. "As I finish this short and scrappy description of a strangely human event," wrote Private Frederick Heath, "we are pouring rapid fire into the German trenches, and they are returning the compliment just as fiercely. So we are back once more to the ordeal of fire." We turn now to the best columns in the U.S. First from Ezra Klein at thewashingtonpost.com, "A problem bigger than inequality." "Is inequality really the country's most pressing problem?" asked Ezra Klein. "No, joblessness is. Inequality has become the central focus of the American left, sparking the Occupy Wall Street movement and Bill de Blasio's New York mayoral victory. President Obama recently declared inequality the defining challenge of our time. But while the vast wealth gap between the top 1% and everyone else stirs people's passions, it's not the cause of the problems facing Americans who are struggling. Today, our economy seems mostly back to normal, yet millions of people have been out of work for years. Others cling to low-wage jobs and get no raises. As economist Larry Summers recently pointed out, it's beginning to look as if the U.S. economy no longer is the job creation engine it once was. Almost all the economic growth of the 1990s and 2000s was connected to bubbles. If that's so, merely imposing higher taxes on the rich will not fix what ails us. The goal of policymakers should be full employment through stimulus programs and economic policies that create what Americans need most, jobs. From Dan Murphy at csmonitor.com, "Powerless to stop Syria's slide." President Barack Obama's Syria policy is now dead, said Dan Murphy. Obama's strategy for dealing with the uprising against Bashar al-Assad had long been tentative and incoherent. Reluctant to embroil the U.S. in another messy Mideast conflict, Obama instead chose to half-heartedly provide non-lethal aid and a trickle of weapons to the Western-leaning rebel Free Syrian Army, FSA, all the while hoping those arms wouldn't fall into the hands of Islamist rebels, who are as hostile to U.S. interest as they are to those of Bashar al-Assad. That strategy failed. Last week, U.S. officials announced they were suspending aid to opposition fighters after Islamic militants overran the headquarters of the FSA and seized warehouses filled with U.S.-supplied weapons, apparently forcing FSA Chief General Salim Idris to flee to Qatar, a humiliating exit for a rebel leader touted by U.S. officials as the commander of the armed Syrian rebellion. With Islamists gaining control over the rebellion, Obama has no good options left. Direct military involvement? Side with Islamist groups? Back Assad? There's nothing the U.S. can do, even as the bodies mount and the refugees continue to flee. And finally, from Caitlin Toner and Mark Leary at Politico.com, are your political views always right? The more extreme a person's views are, the more they think they are right, said psychologists Caitlin Toner and Mark Leary. In a new study, we found that both hardline conservatives and extreme liberals have a strong sense of belief superiority, with disdain for everyone who doesn't share their views. People with moderate views, on the other hand, didn't think their opinions were the only ones with any merit. They supported a middle-of-the-road approach to solving problems, rather than seeking ideological purity. For example, moderates believe that abortion should be legal in some but not all circumstances, while right-to-lifers and pro-choicers insist on either a total ban or total legality. The phenomenon of belief superiority explains why so many of today's intensely partisan pundits, politicians, and even commenters on online articles sound so smugly confident of their views, and so certain that the other side is 100% wrong, and even evil. It also explains why the politicians they elect to Congress are now so deadlocked in partisan rancor. If your views alone are valid, why compromise? Or even bother to talk to the idiots on the other side? On the Talking Points page, Santa Claus, must he be white? The war on Christmas has reached the North Pole, said Elias Isquith in Salon.com. On Fox News last week, host Megyn Kelly weighed in on the most important question of our age, whether or not Santa Claus, who does not exist, is a white man. Responding to a Slate.com article that proposed making Santa more appealing to black kids, Kelly insisted, Santa is just white. That was a historical truth, she said, as was the fact that Jesus was a white man. How many problems are wrapped up in that? Said Jeffrey Weiss in WashingtonPost.com. First of all, Santa is an imaginary character. Insisting he remain white is like insisting that unicorns can only be one color. Then there's the small matter that his historical inspiration, the 4th century Bishop Nicholas, was from Turkey, so he likely had olive skin. As for Jesus, he wasn't the pale-skinned, blue-eyed wasp of European art, but a swarthy Middle Eastern Jew who probably looked like Yasser Arafat. So the real St. Nicholas probably wasn't fat, didn't wear a red costume, and most certainly didn't have flying reindeer, said Matt Lewis in DailyCaller.com. Madison Avenue created that image of Santa in the 1930s. But we've portrayed Santa as a bearded, chunky white guy for decades. Can't we just leave this cultural institution as he is? Black or Hispanic or Asian parents are free to tell kids Santa is whatever race they'd like. Just don't try to indoctrinate everyone else with your own personal Santa. It's telling that conservatives are so threatened by non-white Santa, by a non-white Santa, said Joel Silberman in LATimes.com. For the Fox News crowd, this is a proxy issue for how they feel about America in which all the bedrock institutions, churches, government, and businesses have crumbled or lost credibility. A white Kris Kringle is one of the last tethers to an idealized Norman Rockwell past. But as a Jew who dresses up like Santa every year to give out presents to poor kids, along with dozens of other Santas, white, Latino, black, Asian, I can assure you that what makes America and Santa great transcends race. As the old motto says, e pluribus unum, out of many, one. Or as Santa would have put it, ho, ho, ho. We turn now over to the health and science page. When Mars had a life-friendly lake, NASA scientists have discovered evidence that a large freshwater lake existed on Mars billion of years ago, further strengthening the case that Earth's neighbor once harbored life. The lake was part of a network of waterways that could have lasted thousands or even millions of years, possibly long enough for simple organisms to take hold there. Those conclusions come from an analysis of two mudstones drilled by the Curiosity rover during its exploration of the 96-mile-wide Gale Crater. The analysis dates the lake's existence to about 3.5 billion years ago, roughly the same time life emerged on the Earth, when Mars was warm and wet rather than the cold and arid place it is today. The mudstones contained clay minerals, which form in waters with neutral pH, along with carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, sulfur, nitrogen, and phosphorus, all elements critical to life as we know it. They also contained iron and sulfur minerals that could have been food for microbes, like chemolithoautotrophs, which live on Earth deep underground and in caves and hydrothermal vents. All the essential ingredients for life were present, Caltech geologist John Grotzinger tells the New York Times. The whole thing seems extremely like Earth. Speaking of water, fresh water under the ocean. Vast reserves of fresh water have been discovered beneath the seabed of continental shelves off Australia, China, North America, and South Africa, a potentially valuable resource for coastal cities needing to alleviate water shortages or combat drought. The finding comes from a new analysis of seafloor water studies conducted for oil and gas exploration purposes. The total volume of these untapped reserves is an estimated 120,000 cubic miles, 100 times greater than the amount we've extracted from the Earth's subsurface in the past century since 1900, Australian hydrogeologist Vincent Post tells ScienceDaily.com. The reserves were formed hundreds of thousands of years ago when sea levels were much lower and much of the ocean floor was dry land. Rainwater seeped into the ground and filled up the water table, which was later sealed off by protective layers of clay and sediment and covered as the oceans rose. Scientists say that the water could be tapped by drilling, and that its salinity is low enough that it could be converted readily into potable water. By 2025, two-thirds of the world's population will no longer have a secure water supply, according to the United Nations. And the health scare of the week, antacids' hidden danger. People who take antacids for heartburn should be aware. Prolonged use increases the likelihood of vitamin B12 deficiency, which can contribute to health problems including depression, nerve damage, and dementia, NPR.com reports. An examination of the records of 26,000 patients at Kaiser Permanente clinics between 1997 and 2011 found that those who took a class of drugs known as proton pump inhibitors, sold over-the-counter as Prilosec, Prevacid, and Nexium, for 2 years or more, had a 65% higher than normal risk of B12 deficiency. Those who took the acid-inhibiting drugs called histamine 2 receptor antagonists, contained in the brands such as Pepcid and Zantac, also experienced an increased but more modest risk. Unlike chewable tablets that neutralize stomach acids, the medications examined in the study shut down cells in the stomach responsible for producing acid. Those same cells also make a protein that helps with vitamin B12 absorption. It's not that people should stop the medication, said Kaiser gastroenterologist Douglas Corley. They should check with their physician to be screened. Vitamin deficiencies can often be effectively treated with vitamin supplements. We'll take in one of the obituaries this week. The actor who portrayed Lawrence of Arabia, Peter O'Toole, 1932 to 2013. Peter O'Toole was known as much for his hell-raising ways as he was for his acting. He and his buddies Richard Burton and Richard Harris drank, skirt-chased, and laughed their way through two decades and multiple cities. Harris once claimed to have gone for a drink in Paris and awakened in Corsica. "My idea of heaven," he explained, "is moving from one smoke-filled room to another." O'Toole was the son of an Irish bookkeeper who moved his family to Yorkshire, England, when O'Toole was a boy, said the Daily Telegraph. After working as a newspaper reporter, a jazz drummer, and a vacuum cleaner salesman, O'Toole was so moved by actor Michael Redgrave's portrayal of King Lear in 1953 that he hitchhiked to London to attend drama school. With an arresting presence, he seemed destined for greatness on the stage. But his career shifted largely to the movies on the strength of his performance as the charismatic hero of David Lean's 1962 film, Lawrence of Arabia. O'Toole became an overnight sensation as Lawrence, with his almost pretty face and mesmerizing blue eyes lighting up the screen, said the Washington Post. He was nominated for an Oscar and also earned nominations for Beckett, 1964, The Lion in Winter, 1968, and Goodbye, Mr. Chips, 1969. His star faded in the 1970s as his drinking caught up with him. In 1980, his overwrought and hammy performance as Macbeth in London brought derisive laughter. O'Toole made a startling comeback in the late 1980s, said the Chicago Tribune, having finally given up carousing. He played a kindly English teacher in The Last Emperor, 1987, and lit up the West End stage the following year as a booze-hound journalist in the hit play Jeffrey Bernard is Unwell. He accepted an honorary Oscar in 2003 after 7 unsuccessful nominations for Best Actor, but tried to defer the honor until he was 80. "I was still in the game and might yet win the lovely bugger outright," he said. He was nominated for an 8th time in 2007, only to lose once more. "Acting," he said, "is just being human. Some make it their entire life. Big mistake." Our article from the Last Word section this week: Seduced by Twitter. "I was prepared to hate writing 140-character tweets," said Catherine Schultz. "Instead, tweeting took over my life. I joined Twitter with very bad grace on March 5th, 2010. I was a few months away from publishing my first book, and my agent, editor, publicist, and assorted other media-savvy types sat me down and informed me that if I cared even an iota about its commercial fate, I would make a book trailer and set up an author website and get on Facebook and sign up for Twitter. Having just spent 4 years essentially living alone in a cave with what I privately referred to as my panther and publicly to seem sane, referred to as the book I was working on, I found all these suggestions disorienting, un-me-ish, and silly. But I was new to the publishing industry, and I am something of a good girl at heart, and so I did what I was told. The book trailer, which I made with a filmmaker friend, turned out to be very fun, very pointless. The website now functions chiefly as the place from which I poach my own bio when I'm called upon to provide one. My interest in Facebook lasted a month, then lapsed into profound, unbudgeable boredom. But Twitter, man, the medium I mocked most, the one I joined last and was sure I'd quit first, the hardest to initially understand and the most seemingly inane, the one so easily vilified from afar as antithetical to nuance, substance, elegance, depth, the one most at odds with my own country mile prose, also the one I adore, the one to which I am addicted, and the one that, over the course of the past 3 years, in tiny nibbles exactly the size of this sentence, has proceeded to eat me alive. This essay is not a renunciation, nor is it a vilification. I love Twitter, a complicated love that includes agape and occasionally some eros, and for sure the capital P platonic love of fine minds meeting. And also, who knows, probably sibling rivalry and Stockholm syndrome. In fact, this piece is about love. It's an attempt to understand why I fell for this particular medium, and what doing so has meant for all the other things I love in life. And it is also an attempt to understand what Twitter has done to my mind. That is, how Twitter has changed the way it feels for me to think, write, and simply exist in today's world. I owe an apology to anyone who was following me those first few months after I joined Twitter. On the good side, that includes almost nobody. On the bad side, I signed up under professional duress, and it showed. My book was about being wrong, and my handle back then, at Wrongologist, which I can no longer type without cringing, tells you everything you need to know about my early Twitter persona. For all of 2010, my feed was wrongness heavy, and because I joined so reluctantly, tweet light. 28 of them in March, 23 in April, 13 in May. I know those numbers because I recently downloaded my Twitter archive, which, in addition to the actual tweets, comes with a month-by-month usage breakdown. Here's mine. 13 tweets in May 2010. 553 tweets in May 2013. I am, on average, tweeting 45 times more per day than I used to. Put differently, I somehow went from 370 tweets in all of 2010 to 5,167 in the first 10 months of this year. That huge quantitative shift began as a subtle qualitative shift. In November 2010, already privately a bit bored with wrongness, I broke form, or more aptly, began to find it, and tweeted a video about cephalopods. Then came an intrepid 19th century nurse and her irresistibly titled book, On Sledge and Horseback to Outcast Siberian Lepers. One evening in December, on the train home from a literary event, I tweeted a handful of imaginary book band mashups. Pale Arcade Fire, Rabbit, Run DMC, When Bad Things Happen to Good Village People. A stranger tweeted back at me, Jane Air Supply. Ha, I thought, this is fun. That was the beginning of my Twitter fall, or rise, or whatever direction I'm heading here. What I can tell you is that by January 2011, the wrongness tweets had all but disappeared. By February, I'm tweeting about Libyan politics, lenticular cloud formations, hand-carved tombstones in Transylvania, and the mesmerizing weirdness of Robin's video for Dancing on My Own. By April, forgive me, I tweet my first cat. In October, I drop the @wrongologist handle in favor of @Catherine Schultz. But that is an ex post action if ever there was one. On Twitter, I've long since become myself. In the book nerd circles where I hang out, the most famous Twitter hater is by far Jonathan Franzen, who has accused the service of being unspeakably dumb, a coercive development, the ultimate irresponsible medium, and everything I oppose. I love Franzen's work, but reading him on the topic of Twitter drives me bidirectionally bonkers. Direction 1. His opinions are bad-tempered. Incurious, oversimplified, recklessly arrived at, he has no idea how Twitter works, and in many respects, flat wrong. Direction 2. He can be so petulant, so dogmatic, so uninformed, and, in the deepest ways, where it matters most, so disturbingly right? What Franzen is wrong about is what actually transpires on Twitter. It's not unspeakably dumb. The problem, in fact, is that it's sufficiently smart and interesting that spending massive amounts of time on it is totally possible and semi-defensible. Collectively, the people I follow on Twitter, book nerds, science nerds, journalists, the uncategorizably interesting, come pretty close to my dream community. They also function as by far the best news source I've ever used. More panoptic, more in-depth, more likely to teach me something, much more timely, cumulatively more self-correcting and sophisticated. Additionally, they're immensely generous with their time and knowledge. In contradistinction to the most internet agoras, the Twitter I know is helpful, polite, and friendly. It's also a meritocracy. Say enough interesting things, and other people will begin to engage with you. One other thing to which Franzen is interestingly blind, whatever else Twitter is, it's a literary form, which goes some way toward explaining why I find it so seductive. A tweet is basically a genre in which you try to say an informative thing in an interesting way while abiding by its constraint, those famous 140 characters. For people who love that kind of challenge, and it's easy to see why writers might be overrepresented among them, Twitter has the same allure as gaming. Wide-ranging, intellectually stimulating, big-hearted, super fun. Wait, so what exactly is the problem here? For many people, there isn't one. Unfortunately, I am not one of those people. Chiefly because I am way too susceptible to that other Twitter IPO, its infinite procrastination opportunities. And here is where Franzen got it right. I am convinced that steadily attending to an idea is the core of intellectual labor, and I gravely worry that Twitter undermines that capacity for sustained attention. I know it has undermined my own. I've watched my distractibility increase over the last few years, felt my time get divided into even skinnier and less productive chunks. More disturbing, I have felt my mind get divided into tweet-sized chunks as well. It's one thing to spend a lot of time on Twitter. It's another thing, when I'm not on it, to catch myself thinking of and thinking in tweets. In context, though, it's more complicated than that. Because thinking in tweets is only a half step removed from what I've done all my life, which is to try to match words to thoughts and experiences. The job of a writer is to do that in a sustained way, a job I find brutally hard and, when it works, deeply gratifying. The trouble with Twitter is that it produces a watered-down version of that gratification at a very rapid rate, with minimal investment, and, if I am going to be honest with myself, minimal payoff and minimal point. I began this piece by noting that writing my book involved spending 4 years in a figurative cave. In my experience, that cave is the necessary setting for serious writing. Unfortunately, it is also a dreadful place. Cold, dark, desperately lonely. Twitter, by contrast, is a warm, cheerful, readily accessible 24-hour-a-day antidote to isolation. And that is exactly the issue. The trouble with Twitter isn't that it's full of inanity and self-promoting jerks. The trouble is that it's a solution to a problem that shouldn't be solved. 80% of the battle of writing involves keeping yourself in that cave, waiting out the loneliness and the opacity and emptiness and frustration and bad sentences and dead ends and despair until the damn thing resolves into words. That kind of patience, a steady turning away from everything but the mind and the topic at hand, can only be accomplished by cultivating the habit of attention and a tolerance for solitude. Twitter is also a habit, and a far easier one to fall into. To a significant extent, habits are private things, ours to form and break. And I don't think I'm off the hook for changing my own behavior. But I never had much trouble exercising self-discipline in the name of writing before Twitter came along. And I'm not sure its creators and the culture that sustains it should be wholly let off the hook, either. Even Clive Thompson shares my qualms here. And he is a technology champion who argues that services like Twitter change our minds for the better. The one complaint about the internet that I wholeheartedly endorse, he said, is that most of these tools have been designed to peck at us like ducks. Their business models are built on advertising, and advertising wants us as many minutes of your day as possible. In other words, the addictive nature of Twitter is a feature, not a bug. But with apologies for changing metaphors midstream, it feels like a bug to me. There is a class of parasites in nature that hijacks the nervous system of other creatures, causing them to behave in ways that are against those creatures' best interests, but in the interests of the parasite. A flatworm called Euploricus californicus, for instance, takes over a species of fish and makes it swim to the surface and wiggle around, thereby rendering it highly visible to hungry birds passing overhead. Bummer for the fish, but great for the flatworm who dreams of an afterlife in an avian gut. I sometimes think that Twitter is such a parasite, and that I am one of those hosts, so effectively has it hacked my brain. Ask me what I love most in my life, and how I want to spend what limited allotment I have, and I will tell you that I want to be around friends and family, or reading or writing or in the outdoors, body and mind at play in the world. Ask me what I did today, where all the hours went, and, well, check my Twitter feed. This is from Catherine Schultz, copyright 2013, by New York Media. In this season of joy, let's read a couple of short pieces from It Wasn't All Bad. A man badly injured in the Boston Marathon bombing has become engaged to a woman who helped nurse him back to health. James Costello, who was watching at the race's finishing line, was severely burned and cut by shrapnel in the April 15th attacks. He met Krista D'Agostino while recuperating in the rehabilitation hospital where she works as a nurse. The couple began dating and decided to marry. "I now realize why I was involved in the tragedy," Costello said. "It was to meet my best friend and the love of my life." A deaf father heard his daughter's singing voice for the first time last week, when she surprised him with a Christmas song after he had a hearing aid fitted. Ken Stell of St. Louis had been deaf since birth, but is now able to hear some sounds using a wireless device. Soon after he had the device fitted, his daughter Ashley surprised him at her school Christmas concert with a solo serenade. Ashley, whose mother is also deaf, said she always found it heartbreaking that her parents couldn't hear her sing. But now my dad can hear me, and it's awesome. It was a good week for art therapy after George Zimmerman drew eBay bids of more than $110,000 for a painting he made as a therapeutic outlet. The painting by the gun enthusiast depicts the American flag with the words, "With liberty and justice for all." It was a good week for man's best friend after a guide dog jumped onto New York City subway tracks and began licking his blind owner, who had fainted and fallen in front of an oncoming train. The two survived when they ducked down and the train passed over them. It was a bad week for James Bond after British scientists analyzed the vast amounts of alcohol quaffed by the super spy in Ian Fleming's novels and concluded 007 would develop alcoholic liver disease, cirrhosis, and impotence, and would probably die at age 56. And finally, only in America. For the second straight year, a vengeful Louisiana woman adorned her house's roof with Christmas lights in the shape of a middle finger as a holiday message to a feuding neighbor. Sarah Childs won a court case for the right to display the finger and says flipping the bird is a relatively mild way to express her anger. "You know, lots of people just resort to violence," she said. And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.